Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
So the Farm Capital Investment Index improved this month. It came in at 45 versus 42 for an index value. You compare that to a year ago, that index was at 36, and then you go back 2 years ago, it was at 50.
Talking the Ag Economy Barometer, Dr. Jim Minter.
The improvement this month is interesting, and it's consistent, I guess, with the modest improvement that we saw in the barometer, although maybe in some respects exceeds the improvement that we saw in the barometer. But the interesting thing to me of this one is, if you go back to the low point in 2022, that index got down to as low as 31. So it's climbed 14 points since, I think, the fall of 2022. That's a big move for this index. That's a much more positive value than what we were seeing as recently as last fall.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
It's not necessarily more placements, but I think we've seen a bit of slower marketings here in July.
Lee Schultz is an Iowa State livestock economist. Looking at the latest cattle on feed report.
That's due to, I think some packers running a bit slower over that period with some days off for some maintenance. And that really showed up in some of those marketing numbers, which build up some cattle supplies in particular states. This isn't an indication that supplies are growing or anything. I think it is just an indication of maybe those slower marketings. Cattle supplies remain very tight, and that is supportive of the markets.
But when we get reports, one of the questions we need to be asking is, what is a cow?
When you think about all those reports, remember that we just talked about, different agencies use different definitions of a cow. So when we think about, for example, USDA NAS, and we're thinking about the cattle on feed reports and the cattle inventory reports, their cows in that cattle inventory report, really, we're thinking about the production or inventory characteristics of them. So they provide us beef cow numbers, dairy cow or milk cow numbers, and then replacement heifer numbers for both of those categories of beef and dairy. And as compared to maybe USDA's Ag Marketing Service, is more concerned about reporting those cows of how they're marketed. So given the body condition scores of those cows, the grades that those cows receive, and the relative prices that those cows receive.
And on dairy cattle?
When we looked at that cattle inventory report, maybe a bit surprising was that the milk cow inventory was the same as a year ago. Right. As we look at margins for the dairy industry, you would maybe expect some contraction. But I think, one, the relatively high fixed cost says you got to continue to produce in the short run as long as you're covering variable costs. Now, also, I think when you look at replacement heifer prices, which USDA NAS also reports for dairy farms, those prices are relatively strong, again, given where margins are currently at. So I think there's a bit of optimism in the dairy market. I think when you look at forecasts for 2024 milk prices, there is possibility for notable increases in those prices. And then I think we have to remember that milk isn't the only thing dairy operations are producing. When you look at the price of dairy calves going into feeder cattle, those are very strong right now, right? So that is, I think, helping support some of that income and maybe some of the reason why we've not seen the contraction in the dairy industry that we expected.
Then there's the issue of crossed beef dairy cattle.
When you think about market analysis, I think one key factor there is there is the opportunity to maybe report those separately, as we're seeing growing use of sex semen and artificial insemination, the ability to use that for the highest percentage of dairy animals and then breed the other percentage to beef crossbreeds to really maximize the value of those calves. Now, as we think about how those animals are currently reported, USDA, there's just buckets for beef and there's buckets for dairy. And so those crossbreds go into one of those categories. Now, as we're seeing growing numbers, I think it is important for price discovery, understanding the value of those calves, what those crossbreds will bring relative to beef, relative to dairy, if we could see separate reporting of those crossbred calves. And so I think, when we think about changes to livestock management reporting, that is one that comes to mind, and opportunities to, split out the animals, both the number of head as well as the prices received for those crossbreds.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Every time we took an action against China, human rights abuses, democracy in Hong Kong, the White House would get inundated with calls from the most famous businessmen on Wall Street complaining about what we were doing. Sometimes businessmen in the gaming industry upset with us for taking action against China.
Speaking recently at the Hudson Institute, Robert O'Brien, former National Security Advisor.
American companies, for the most part, in the tech sector have started to realize the risk of doing business in China. Now, selling to the Chinese is great. I mean, that reduces our trade deficit, it gives them the products they need. But when you go into business in China and you have to do a joint venture with a Chinese company, you have to have a political commissar in your from the CCP in your company telling you what you can and can't do. When you have to turn over all your data and your information on your company to the Chinese, when you have to share your patents with your Chinese partners, that's a bad idea. And most companies and manufacturing companies are starting to realize that. They realize that you really don't own a factory in China. You're renting a factory in China from the Chinese Communist Party. But the one area of our economic sector, and it happens to be incredibly powerful, that's just as in love with China, is Wall Street. You know, you've got guys like Ray Dalio and Schwartzman and these guys who just, you know, they love China. And there's lots of love about the Chinese people, don't get me wrong. But the Chinese Communist Party is a very threat to our liberty. And they keep investing in China because they think eventually China's going to become free. Maybe they think that. At least I hope that's their motivation. And they think that their bank or their hedge fund or the return they're going to get on their investment from investing in Chinese companies is going to make them rich. What I used to say is that there are a lot of houses in the Hamptons that were built by the Chinese Communist Party, and a lot of nice houses in the Hamptons that were built by the CCP. And it was a pretty cheap way for the CCP to have tremendous access in this country. But look, we're a free country, and there's only so much we can do to regulate what American companies want to do. But what I tell them is, if a war breaks out in the Chinese Taiwan Straits and between America and China, or relations get worse, there are going to be heavy economic sanctions. I mean, the toolkit that America has immediately in a war is economic sanctions, because we want to avoid rising to a kinetic level. Now, that may not be true in the Taiwan Strait if there's an invasion in Taiwan, but if there's a blockade or cyber attacks or actions against Taiwan, the first reaction in America is going to be economic sanctions. But the Chinese have been preparing for that for many years, and they're trying to suck as much American investment, especially from Wall Street, into China as they can, because they don't want their bonds canceled, they don't want their dollar holdings canceled, they want to have something to fight back with, and the way they'll fight back is by nationalizing U.S. investment in China. So the more U.S. investment they can get in China, the more leverage they can have over us, and the more they can mitigate any financial sanctions down the road in the event of a conflict or a crisis between the countries. Now, the Wall Street guys think, well, that's okay because the U.S. government will bail us out. We always get bailed out. We're too big to fail. Wall Street, it doesn't matter what happens, Wall Street gets bailed out. The little guy may go bankrupt, but Wall Street's going to get bailed out. And I assume they feel that they're going to get bailed out, but I think the consensus, the American public is not going to go for bailing out BlackRock or any of these companies that have made massive bets on China.
But says awareness is the first step.
This is how we start to raise the awareness of the American people of what's happening. And Arthur Herman and I wrote an article recently in Foreign Affairs that kind of laid out some of the things we should be doing as America, not just on semiconductors, but across all sectors and all regions, and maintain our way of life and protect our liberty and do so in a modern fashion. We're not just going to be agricultural people. We're going to be modern people. We're going to have technology. We're going to remain the leaders in tech. And we can do it as Americans, and we're going to prevail in this competition between tyranny and autocracy and liberty and the rule of law, and we're going to do it in a way that maintains our economy and maintains our prosperity.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I'm Ken McCarty, and I look forward to discussing what regenerative agriculture means to McCarty family farms.
Talking soil health last year in front of the House Ag Committee.
My three brothers and I are fourth generation dairy farmers, originally from a small farm in Bradford County, Pennsylvania, where my family farmed for more than 100 years. In the late 90s, my parents began searching for opportunities that would allow my brothers and I to continue our family's farm. Eventually, that led us to Rexford, Kansas, where we have gradually grown our business to include five dairies. Three dairies in northwest Kansas, one in southwest Nebraska, and most recently a partnership dairy with another fourth generation family farm in Mercer County, Ohio. We also own and operate a milk condensing plant at the Rexford Farm that reduces the freight to move our finished products by 75% while reclaiming 65,000 gallons of fresh water every day. We are currently in the process of building a state-of-the-art dairy farm near the original Rexford Dairy and expanding the processing capacity of the milk plant. Continually improving our farm management and implementing sustainable farming practices is key to the success and growth of our business. Every day, we strive to create wholesome dairy foods in a responsible and sustainable manner, and we are deeply committed to regenerative ag practices and have been recognized as a leader in that space. For example, McCarty Family Farms is Validus Dairy Care certified, Farm Program verified, and are certified B Corp. And for the past 2 years, we've been recognized as a best for the world B Corp in the environmental impact area. We've also received multiple awards from the U.S. Dairy Innovation Center, National Milk Producers Federation, IDFA, the state of Kansas, and others. Also, since 2016, we have worked annually with sustainable environmental consultants to evaluate and verify our ecosystem impact, which is reported publicly on our website. This approach to transparency and third-party validation helps us market our milk and creates a foundation for sustainable business growth. As an example, we sell most of our milk to Danone North America, another certified B Corp and a leading global food and beverage company, who processes our milk into products such as Danon, Oikos, Activia, and Light and Fit yogurts. Regenerative agriculture may be a buzzword for some, but for McCarty Family Farms, it is a holistic mindset that encourages us to consider a multitude of practices across our farms, especially those associated with core values like soil health, resource conservation, animal welfare, and the welfare of our team members, families, and communities. Practices such as cover crops, reduced tillage, improved nutrient management, and excellent animal care practices under one coherent vision can optimize the performance and sustainability of our farms. In general, regenerative agriculture should provide measurable economic, social, and environmental benefits that help improve rather than just sustain our ecosystems. And we've been able to demonstrate just that. For example, water conservation technologies have helped to save millions of gallons of fresh water every year while reducing our input costs. Enhancements to animal welfare have helped ensure more milk production with fewer resources consumed. For McCarty Family Farms and our partners, regenerative agriculture must move beyond a qualitative concept towards making decisions based on quantitative outcomes. By benchmarking and tracking our environmental and economic performance, we can better understand the impacts and make better business decisions. In general, these regenerative efforts have helped demonstrate that dairy farming and all of agriculture can be a part of the solution for our climate and our economy, while of course helping to feed the world. At times, USDA programs are helpful to incentivize new ideas and reduce upfront costs when a clear short-term ROI isn't possible. And while we know regenerative practices produce economic benefits in the long term, such as increased efficiency and resilient yields and improved market opportunities, upfront costs can still be a barrier to implementation. Traditional ag lending looks year to year, while regenerative agriculture takes a longer-term view, which is why conservation funding and incentives are crucial to greater adoption.
To agriculture today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I've been trying to make a point on the scale of the debt, the level we're at, the misunderstanding on its growth, and some potential solutions.
Arizona Representative David Schweikert.
I've shown this a half dozen times, and I keep showing it because this is what I have bad dreams about. Yeah, if you live in a world of math, and I know this is functionally a math-free zone, but when we finished the debt ceiling deal, we basically got some applause by economists saying, oh, guys, you basically moved yourself from maybe 120 to maybe 115% of debt to GDP at the end of the 9 years. Okay, so that was the CBO number. But then some of the outside economists came in. Moody's Analytics said, hey, guys, there's other things going on. The higher interest rates, the dramatic increase in spending in Medicare. Remember, the first 7 months of this year, we spent 16% more on Medicare. Next year's interest will functionally be $750 billion. $750 billion. We weren't supposed to hit numbers like that for years. But the one that took my breath away was when the Bloomberg economists, and these aren't slouches, and they have a really good data system, said their model was coming back and saying, okay, higher interest rates, higher health care costs, lower labor force participation, some of the other things we don't talk about because it doesn't really fit our scenario. And I'm going to hyper-simplify this, and I've done this a handful of times, but I'm trying to get the concept through. So as part of the deal, 6 weeks ago, the $700 billion that's in the non-defense discretionary, we're going to cut $100 billion of that. Okay, great. Bloomberg economists basically say the removal of that $100 billion, it's necessary. It also slows down the economy by about a half a percent of GDP. We don't seem to understand when we do policies like this, which we need to do, you also have to be adopting policies that backfill the growth. And this place can barely walk and chew gum. And that's why this number here was so terrifying when the Bloomberg economists are saying, hey, at functionally that 9-year window, 10 years from now, and what reason we say 9 years, because we're already working on next year's budget and appropriations and spending, is 130% of debt to GDP, $51 trillion of borrowing. And if interest rates even go back to a somewhat more normal number, that's almost $2 trillion a year in interest. That's functionally 9 years from now. And we're going to do what? We're not going to talk about it. We're going to be just giddy that, hey, look at the hard work we did. We removed $100 billion out of discretionary. And let's see, this year, and I know my math is different than Congressional Budget Office, and come the end of September, we'll find out which one of us had a better calculator. But I've been right more times this year than they have. And I know that's boastful, but I can prove it, because go back and look at some of my floor speeches, and then we've gotten the quarterly reports from Treasury. I have, this fiscal year, us coming in around $1,820 to $840 billion of borrowing. Why is that important? The 2023 fiscal year discretionary, defense included, so defense and non-defense discretionary was supposed to be total spend, $1,836 billion, basically meaning every dime of what you think of as government is on borrowed money this year. When we go home and talk to our constituents, do we basically say, hey, do you know all of defense, all of the Supreme Court, all of the State Department, all of everything you think of as government is on borrowed money?
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
This is not a football competition. It's not a competition between, you know, who's the top-ranked school and second-ranked school and third-ranked school. This is a competition about whose way of life is going to prevail.
Former National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien speaking recently at the Hudson Institute about China.
As you mentioned, the Chinese don't play by the rules. The intellectual property theft that's taken place over the last 30, 40 years has been what Christopher Wray, the director of the FBI, said 2 summers ago in a speech that he gave. The biggest transfer of human wealth in history has been the theft, not the economic development of China, which if it was done fairly, we'd all applaud, but the theft of American and Western intellectual property and the transfer of that to China. Biggest in human history. Now, I think a lot of you have been to Rome. You've seen the Trajan's Column, and it shows, you know, the Romans bringing back all the cart fulls, the ox cart fulls of Dacian loot that kept, you know, Rome going for another 100 years with everything that they looted from Dacia. That used to be kind of considered the biggest theft of property in history. But what China has done makes what Trajan did in Dacia, Romania, that area of the world, you know, that's child's play, it's kindergarten. I mean, the Chinese have literally stolen trillions of dollars from us. So when you talk about competition, it's hard to compete with someone who's stealing, you know, everything in your house. If you're competing with your neighbor, you're trying to keep up with the Joneses, but the Joneses are coming into your house and stealing all your stuff as soon as you buy it. That's not really competition. And there's going to be no way to keep up with China if we continue to allow this to happen. But it's just not on the theft part. If it was just stealing our IP, that would be bad enough. And we can talk more about that in a moment, how that plays out and hurts individual Americans. But it's the unfair trade practices. It's claiming to be a developing nation under WTO rules. It's violating all the norms of the just human decency when it comes to climate. I mean, we talk about climate change here and the hot weather this summer and what we can do about it. There's nothing we can do about it because China is opening a new coal-fired plant every month. So even if we closed every coal plant in America and every coal plant in the West, China's building so many of them that it'll make no difference. I mean, the atmosphere is the same for all of us. It's the world's interconnected and across the Pacific. You know, if the Chinese are pumping, you know, dirty coal-fired plant emissions into the atmosphere, there's very little we can do about it. It's the same with the Pacific Ocean. I mean, in the old days, conservationists cared about clean water and clean air. And hopefully they still do here in America, but the water in China is the dirtiest in the world. But what they've done in the Pacific Ocean, there's now an island. Think of this, there's an island bigger than the Big Island of Hawaii of garbage, plastic, floating around in the Pacific Ocean right now. Most of it came from the Chinese and from their shipping and their ecological practices. So we've got this island of garbage, and no one cares. No one's calling the Chinese out on it. So it's very difficult for American companies and Western companies to abide by the rules, to do what the EPA tells them to do, do what OSHA tells them to do. I mean, we talk about worker safety, and the Chinese shipyards are impressive. They launch these ships, and we launch two or three destroyers a year at best. They're launching a destroyer every month or a frigate every month. But there are massive injuries that take place to Chinese workers. They lose 60, 70, 80 workers a year to deaths in the shipyards. But when you go to Huntington Ingalls or Bath Iron Works or Newport News, they'll have signs up that say zero deaths or zero injuries for 24 months, 36 months. So the way we treat workers, the way we treat our environment, the way we treat the rules we abide by aren't abided by the Chinese. So a very long answer to get to your question. It's hard to compete when someone's stealing from you, when they're not abiding by the rules, when they're, anything goes. That's not a competition. And so we have to figure out a different way, a different model to deal with the Chinese.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
My name is Rick Clark. I'm a fifth-generation farmer from West Central Indiana, and we farm about 7,000 acres of row crops.
Testifying before the previous Congress on regenerative ag.
Folks, this is urgent, and it's critical that we have bipartisan action on the topic at hand today. I am a Republican, and I've spoken to thousands of farmers across this country, and not once has my party affiliation come up. The witnesses here today do not represent the diversity of regenerative farmers and ranchers. We are especially missing voices of indigenous leaders and farmers of color. And it is critical in this farming journey that you have the support of your family. And I'm going to tell you, they have my back. American farmers are the most productive in the world, but we have to acknowledge the condition our soils are in. We are in trouble. 5.6 tons per acre per year of soil are leaving our fields. I'm not here today to offend the practices of any farmer, and we have to understand the heritage and history they have. We also need to understand our soil is fragile and degrading right in front of our eyes, which leads me to why I'm here today. Adopting soil health practices can slow down and reverse the degradation of soil. I want to leave you today with the confidence that regenerative agriculture can be incorporated into any farming operation and be far better for your bottom line. After decades of heavy tillage on our farm, a one-inch rain event created so much erosion on our farm, I knew it was time to do something different. Like thousands of farmers, I started cover cropping through EQIP. This is an essential program to increase farmers' comfort level of change. In my written testimony, there is a photo of my soil and my neighbor's soil just 20 feet apart from each other. The difference is astounding. My soils have water infiltration rates of 20 inches per hour, and the neighbors have an infiltration rate of 1/2 inch of rain per hour. Our soils have 1.5 million earthworms per acre. The neighbors' farms have nearly zero earthworms. So, how do we get there? We need to follow the 6 principles of soil health. 1, context. This is key. While practices change from Texas to Indiana, principles are universal. 2, minimize disturbance. 3, maximize diversity. 4, living roots. 5, armor the soil. 6, animal integration. A little bit more about our operation. We have not used starter fertilizer, seed treatments, fungicides, insecticides, pesticides, phosphorus, or potassium in 8 years. And to boot, we're organic with no tillage. I am far down this path, but any farm can start and experience incredible results with ecologically and economically, especially with proper education and support. And note, it doesn't have to be organic. Cover crops are doing more than protecting and building soil. Our operation, cover crops, have become an offensive juggernaut, with cereal rye giving us upwards of $435 per acre worth of NP&K, and legume cover crops giving us upwards of $969 worth of value when terminated with a roller crimper at maturity. Most farmers can't achieve this without tools, education, and changes to crop insurance rules that require termination well before maturity. On our farm, we have currently reduced diesel fuel consumption by 50%, chemistry and fertility by 100%, and based on regional input spending averages, we are saving $1,957,000 annually.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
What's a Category 4 hurricane? Now remnants.
Hurricane Hilary, in its remnant form as a tropical storm, became the first tropical cyclone since September of 1939 to have an inland tropical storm position over California.
Occurring near Palm Springs late Sunday afternoon, a later advisory was issued for western Nevada.
It is now a post-tropical cyclone, no longer fully tropical.
Yet impacts are evident in those areas, including
excessive rainfall, meaning about a year's worth of rain falling in just a day's time. Those 4 to 8 inch rainfall totals in the deserts of Southern California has led to some significant flash flooding and debris flows, quite a few road closures.
Plus wind-related impacts.
We actually did see some pretty impressive winds on the eastern side of the circulation.
In areas such as Yuma, Arizona and Imperial, California, recording 60-plus mile-per-hour winds. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.